In fact, if N voters were questioned, the chances that any given number of them would support the mayor are proportional to the numbers on line N of Pascal's triangle. And so, according to de Moivre's work, if pollsters poll a large number of voters, the probabilities of different polling results can be described by the normal distribution. In other words, about 95% of the time, the approval rating they observe in their poll will fall within two standard deviations of the true rating, 50%. Pollsters use the term margin of error to describe this uncertainty. When pollsters tell the media that a poll's margin of error is plus or minus 5%, they mean that if they were to repeat the poll a large number of times, 19 out of 20, 95% of those times, the result would be within 5% of the correct answer. Though pollsters rarely point this out, this also means, of course, that about one time in 20 the result will be wildly inaccurate. As a rule of thumb, a sample of 100 yields a margin of error that is too great for most purposes. A sample of 1,000, on the other hand, usually yields a margin of error in the ballpark of 3%, which, for most purposes, suffices. It is important, whenever assessing any kind of survey or poll, to realize that when it is repeated, we should expect the results to vary. For example, if in reality 40% of registered voters approve of the way the president is handling his job, it is much more likely that six independent surveys will report numbers like 37, 39, 39, 40, 42, and 42, than it is that all six surveys will agree that the president's support stands at 40%. Those six numbers are in fact the results of six independent polls gauging the president's job approval in the first 2 weeks of September 2006. That's why, as another rule of thumb, any variation within the margin of error should be ignored. But although the New York Times will not run the headline, "Jobs and Wages Increased Modestly at 2 p.m., analogous headlines are common in the reporting of political polls. For example, after the Republican National Convention in 2004, CNN ran the headline, "Bush Apparently Gets Modest Bounce." The experts at CNN went on to explain that Bush's convention bounce appeared to be 2 percentage points. The percentage of likely voters who said he was their choice for president rose from 50 right before the convention to 52 immediately afterward. Only later did the reporter remark that the poll's margin of error was plus or minus 3.5 percentage points, which means that the newsflash was, essentially, meaningless. Apparently the word "apparently" in CNN talk means apparently not. For many polls, a margin of error of more than 5% is considered unacceptable. Yet in our everyday lives, we make judgments based on far fewer data points than that. People don't get to play 100 years of professional basketball, invest in 100 apartment buildings, or start 100 chocolate chip cookie companies. And so when we judge their success at those enterprises, we judge them on just a few data points. Should a football team lavish $50 million to lure a guy coming off a single record-breaking year? How likely is it that the stockbroker who wants your money for a sure thing will repeat her earlier successes? Does the success of the wealthy investor of Sea Monkeys mean there is a good chance he'll succeed with his new ideas of invisible goldfish and instant frogs? For the record, he didn't. When we observe a success or a failure, we observe one data point, a sample from under the bell curve that represents the potentialities that previously existed. We cannot know whether our single observation represents the mean or the outlier, an event to bet on or a rare happening that is not likely to be reproduced. But at a minimum, we ought to be aware that a sample point is just a sample point, and rather than accepting it simply as reality, we ought to see it in the context of the standard deviation or the spread of possibilities that produced it. The wine might be rated 91. But that number is meaningless if we have no estimate of the variation that would occur if the identical wine were rated again and again by someone else. It might help to know, for instance, that a few years back, when both the Penguin Good Australian Wine Guide and On Wine's Australian Wine Annual reviewed the 1999 vintage of the Mitchelton Blackwood Park Riesling, the Penguin Guide gave the wine 5 stars out of 5 and named it Penguin Best Wine of the Year, while On Wine rated it at the bottom of all the wines it reviewed, deeming it the worst vintage produced in a decade. The normal distribution not only helps us understand such discrepancies, but also has enabled a myriad of statistical applications widely employed today in both science and commerce. For example, whenever a drug company assesses whether the results of a clinical trial are significant, a manufacturer assesses whether a sample of parts accurately reflects the proportion of those that are defective, or a marketer decides whether to act on the results of a research survey. The recognition that the normal distribution describes the distribution of measurement error came decades after de Moivre's work, by that fellow whose name is sometimes attached to the bell curve, the German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss. It was while working on the problem of planetary motion that Gauss came to that realization, at least regarding astronomical measurements. Gauss's proof, however, was, by his own later admission, invalid. Moreover, its far-reaching consequences also eluded him, and so he slipped the law inconspicuously into a section at the end of a book called The Theory of the Motion of Heavenly Bodies Moving About the Sun in Conic Sections. There it may well have died, just another in the growing pile of abandoned proposals for the error law. It was Laplace who plucked the normal distribution from obscurity. He encountered Gauss's work in 1810, soon after he had read a memoir to the Académie des Sciences, proving a theorem called the Central Limit Theorem, which says that the probability that the sum of a large number of independent random factors will take on any given value is distributed according to the normal distribution. For example, suppose you bake 100 loaves of bread, each time following a recipe that is meant to produce a loaf weighing 1,000 grams. By chance, you will sometimes add a bit more or a bit less flour or milk, or a bit more or less moisture may escape in the oven. If in the end each of a myriad of possible causes adds or subtracts a few grams, the central limit theorem says that the weight of your loaves will vary according to the normal distribution. Upon reading Gauss's work, Laplace immediately realized that he could use it to improve his own, and that his work could provide a better argument than Gauss's to support the notion that the normal distribution is indeed the error law. Laplace rushed to press a short sequel to his memoir on the theorem. Today, the central limit theorem and the law of large numbers are the two most famous results of the theory of randomness. To illustrate how the central limit theorem explains why the normal distribution is the correct error law, let's reconsider Daniel Bernoulli's example of the archer. I played the role of the archer one night after a pleasant interlude of wine and adult company when my younger son Nikolai handed me a bow and arrow and dared me to shoot an apple off his head. The arrow had a soft foam tip, but still it seemed reasonable to conduct an analysis of my possible errors and their likelihood. For obvious reasons, I was mainly concerned with vertical errors. A simple model of the errors is this. Each random factor, say a sighting error, the effect of air currents, and so on, would throw my shot vertically off target, either high or low, with equal probability. My total error in aim would then be the sum of my errors. If I was lucky, about half the component errors would deflect the arrow upward and half downward, and my shot would end up right on target. If I was unlucky, or, more to the point, if my son was unlucky, the errors would all fall one way and my aim would be off, either high or low. The relevant question was, how likely was it that the errors would cancel each other, or that they would add up to their maximum, or that they would take any other value in between? But that was just a Bernoulli process, like tossing coins and asking how likely it is that the tosses will result in a certain number of heads. The answer is described by Pascal's triangle, or, if many trials are involved, by the normal distribution. And that, in this case, is precisely what the central limit theorem tells us. As it turned out, I missed both apple and sun, but did knock over a glass of very nice Cabernet. By the 1830s, most scientists had come to believe that every measurement is a composite, subject to a great number of sources of deviation and hence to the error law. The error law and the central limit theorem thus allowed for a new and deeper understanding of data and their relation to physical reality. In the ensuing century, scholars interested in human society also grasped these ideas and found to their surprise that the variation in human characteristics and behavior often displays the same pattern as the error in measurement. And so, they sought to extend the application of the error law from physical science to a new science of human affairs. Chapter 8. The Order in Chaos. In the mid-1960s, some 90 years old and in great need of money to live on, a Frenchwoman named Jean Calment made a deal with a 47-year-old lawyer. She sold him her apartment for the price of a low monthly subsistence payment, with the agreement that the payments would stop upon her death, at which point she would be carried out and he could move in. The lawyer must have known that Ms. Calment had already exceeded the French life expectancy by more than 10 years. He may not have been aware of Bayes' theory, however, nor known that the relevant issue was not whether she should be expected to die in minus 10 years, but that her life expectancy, given that she had already made it to 90, was about 6 more years. Still, he had to feel comfortable believing that any woman who, as a teenager, had met Vincent van Gogh in her father's shop would soon be joining van Gogh in the hereafter. For the record, she found the artist dirty, badly dressed, and disagreeable. 10 years later, the attorney had presumably found an alternative dwelling, for Jean Calment celebrated her 100th birthday in good health. And though her life expectancy was then about 2 years, she reached her 110th birthday, still on the lawyer's dime. By that point, the attorney had turned 67. But it was another decade before the attorney's long wait came to an end. And it wasn't the end he expected. In 1995, the attorney himself died, while Jean Calment lived on. Her day of reckoning finally came on August 4, 1997, at the age of 122. Her age at death exceeded the lawyer's age at his death by 45 years. Individual lifespans and lives are unpredictable. But when data are collected from groups and analyzed en masse, regular patterns emerge. Suppose you have driven accident-free for 20 years. Then, one fateful afternoon while you're on vacation in Quebec with your spouse and your in-laws, your mother-in-law yells, "Look out for that moose!" and you swerve into a warning sign that says essentially the same thing. To you, the incident would feel like an odd and unique event. But as the need for the sign indicates, in an ensemble of thousands of drivers, a certain percentage of drivers can be counted on to encounter a moose. In fact, a statistical ensemble of people acting randomly often displays behavior as consistent and predictable as a group of people pursuing conscious goals. Or, as the philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote in 1784, "Each, according to his own inclination, follows his own purpose, often in opposition to others. Yet, each individual and people, as if following some guiding thread, go toward a natural, but to each of them, unknown goal. All work toward furthering it, even if they would set little store by it, if they did know it." According to the Federal Highway Administration, for example, there are about 200 million drivers in the United States, and, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. In one recent year, those drivers drove a total of 2.86 trillion miles. That's about 14,300 miles per driver. Now, suppose everyone in the country had decided it would be fun to hit that same total again the following year. Let's compare two methods that could have been used to achieve that goal. In Method 1, the government institutes a rationing system, employing one of the National Science Foundation's supercomputing centers to assign personal mileage targets that meet each of the 200 million motorists' needs while maintaining the previous annual average of 14,300. In Method 2, we tell drivers not to stress over it and to drive as much or as little as they please with no regard to how far they drove the prior year. If Uncle Billy Bob, who used to walk to work at the liquor store, decides instead to log 100,000 miles as a shotgun wholesaler in West Texas, that's fine. And if Cousin Jane in Manhattan, who logged most of her mileage circling the block on street cleaning days in search of a parking space, gets married and moves to New Jersey, we won't worry about that either. Which method would come closer to the target of 14,300 miles per driver? Method 1 is impossible to test, though our limited experience with gasoline rationing indicates that it probably wouldn't work very well. Method 2, on the other hand, was actually instituted. That is, the following year, drivers drove as much or as little as they pleased without attempting to hit any quota. How did they do? According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, that year, American drivers drove 2.88 trillion miles, or 14,400 miles per person, only 100 miles above target. What's more, those 200 million drivers also suffered within less than 200, the same number of fatalities in both years, 42,815 versus 42,643. We associate randomness with disorder. Yet although the lives of 200 million drivers vary unforeseeably, in the aggregate, their behavior could hardly have proved more orderly. Analogous regularities can be found if we examine how people vote, buy stocks, marry, are told to get lost, misaddress letters, or sit in traffic on their way to a meeting they didn't want to go to in the first place. Or if we measure the length of their legs, the size of their feet, the width of their buttocks, or the breadth of their beer bellies. As 19th century scientists dug into newly available social data, wherever they looked, the chaos of life seemed to produce quantifiable and predictable patterns. But it was not just the regularities that astonished them. It was also the nature of the variation. Social data, they discovered, often followed the normal distribution. That the variation in human characteristics and behavior is distributed like the error in an archer's aim led some 19th century scientists to study the targets toward which the arrows of human existence are aimed. More important, they sought to understand the social and physical causes that sometimes move the target. And so, the field of mathematical statistics, developed to aid scientists in data analysis, flourished in a far different realm, the study of the nature of society. Statisticians have analyzed life's data at least since the 11th century, when William the Conqueror commissioned what was, in effect, the first national census. William began his rule in 1035 at age 7, when he succeeded his father as Duke of Normandy. As his moniker implies, Duke William II liked to conquer, and in 1066 he invaded England. By Christmas Day, he was able to give himself the present of being crowned king. His swift victory left him with a little problem. Whom exactly had he conquered? And more important, how much could he tax his new subjects? To answer those questions, he sent inspectors to every part of England to note the size ownership, and resources of each parcel of land. To make sure they got it right, he said,